Mini episode 146 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Royalty Tours USA, your ultimate resource to traveling in style to attend sporting events. Follow them on the web at royaltytours.blogspot.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
All right, welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 146. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross starting the Kyle Ross History of SummerSlam series. We knew going in with WrestleMania it was a nine-part series. We're not even labeling this one because we don't know at this point. We know how we've got it segmented, but we don't know how it's going to play exactly. Rick Morris, Kyle Ross coming at you here. Kyle, this is going to be, again, probably not 16 hours, 20 minutes like WrestleMania was, the Ken Burns one. And my brother laughed when I told him about that because he said he could just see, you know, like some shot of a Civil War general on screen and hearing, I remember watching Ric Flair for the first time in Greenville, North, South Carolina.
You know, the only problem is now that we're doing this, which we knew was going to happen after the WrestleMania ones were over.
Yeah.
You know, in October, here we go, Survivor Series. You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, but, you know, everyone has still lived to tell the story after WrestleMania. And so now we're going to tell a new story about SummerSlam. And I think this should be good. It's not, people don't remember, I think, the matches and angles. And by design, they're not as big.
Right.
But it's still pretty interesting to go back and relive and talk about some of these great old matches and angles.
It really did. As we were doing some of our show prep here and we were talking about this, there had been a couple of precursors to the first SummerSlam in 1988, the biggest one being the big event 2 years previously in August 1986 in Toronto at Exhibition Stadium. I think it was at least a kayfabe 68,000 people showing up to watch Hulk Hogan and Paul Orndorff in the main event of the show.
Which was their big summer program.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, their huge one. That was one of the biggest programs of the 80s that they ran. And you had that one there to a certain extent. And some of these were spring ones. Some were summer. The Zbyszko San Martino one was summer. But the Shea shows in 1972, 76, and 80, warm weather outdoor shows, sort of the same kind of a deal here. So there have been a little bit of that. You pointed out to me WrestleFest in August of 88.
June of 88. Yeah,
or June. June.
In Milwaukee's County Stadium. That drew a big crowd.
Yeah, and that was right after they signed both Terry Taylor and Curt Hennig. I think they had a match on the show. I think that
they
was
do early. Yeah, there was there was a lot of matches on that show with the main event. It was a double main event. It was Savage and DiBiase, and then it was Hogan and Andre in a cage.
Right.
It was one of the was one of the few, if not the only show Hogan worked between WrestleMania and SummerSlam. I could be wrong on it, but it's certainly the only major show because he obviously took the majority of the summer off to film No Holds Barred.
And as you pointed out about the main event, that was essentially, although it was that was at Milwaukee County Stadium, outdoor show, big setting, but essentially a glorified house show. I mean, I think they made a Coliseum home video about
it.
But it wasn't
same with
the
big
thing
event.
Where, but they weren't going on TV and talking about it the next week.
No, it was just a well-attended house show. And now, obviously, when you put a show in a stadium of that size, you're not expecting, you know, a Ring of Honor-sized crowd to show up. But to me, when you look at the time period, 1988, you know, the previous year they'd introduced SummerSlam. Pay-per-view was starting to become
Survivor
a big,
Series.
Survivor Series. Too many, you know, S's here.
Yes.
And pay-per-view was becoming the way. WrestleMania 3, you know, the closed circuit was big with the first couple WrestleManias.
Yep.
So, but pay-per-view, you could clearly see the way Vince had his way with the Survivor Series 87, had destroyed Starrcade.
Yep.
As you know, that Starrcade would then run later in the year. In 1988, they booted Starrcade off Thanksgiving and moved it to, you know, after Christmas.
Right.
A full month later. So this show, twofold. It's an excuse to do another pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a good way to blow off or have a big event for your summer programs because, you know, it's a long time, obviously. And the way that we've moved now to monthly pay-per-views, it's almost unfathomable, you know, just how few big shows there were you would have, because the house shows were such a big deal, obviously, up until the midpoint of the 80s. where you didn't want to have decisive finishes on TV. And now, as you know, that's become the norm.
It has been. And it's funny because as we talk about this again, our approach is going to be a little bit different. And that's why this is going to take less time to get through than WrestleMania, because this is a situation. We talked about it with the first couple of WrestleManias. WrestleMania, by this point in time, was starting at least tenuously to include the biggest programs on the card. SummerSlam, as we will talk about in the first couple of years, made no such effort. I mean, they were saving the big programs still for the house shows. It's as though they were hedging on this. Yes, we're going to try and get more pay-per-view revenue coming in, but we don't want to kill the house shows.
Yeah, and it's not like now where they, you know,
House shows are so secondary.
Yeah, where, you know, now it's like, you know, Brock Lesnar comes back. Hey, let's have him wrestle right away, first pay-per-view.
Right.
3 weeks in. You know, this was, I mean, look at the main events of these first two SummerSlams, tag team main events.
Right.
And as we get into the individual shows, particularly the first one, the card as it's constructed, would never fly as a pay-per-view now.
No.
I mean, it's almost like a three-hour Raw.
It is. There was a lot of undercard garbage on this thing. I mean, most of it was, really. You know, we don't even really need to cover most of the things here. One of the things that I do want to mention in terms of both matches here, because this was in the production notes that you emailed me, the fact that Rick Rude and Jake Roberts, who were in one of the most heated programs of the year, wrestled different opponents. Rude defeated JYD by disqualification in 6:18. Jake Roberts defeated Hercules in 10:06. The fact that they didn't put those two guys in a match, completely indicative of what we're talking about. They were trying to still protect the house shows, and it totally came at the expense of the pay-per-view, because how you have these guys, you know, to say that you can't put these guys in a match on pay-per-view, it sort of begs the question of why you have the pay-per-view in the first place.
Well, yeah, but, you know, this, and we're going to get into this in a moment, you know, this, like many pay-per-views, is essentially drawn from the top. And this show, SummerSlam, another reason that this was specifically introduced at this time, it was an excuse. Hogan came back to team with Randy Savage. Remember, there was like this drama because Savage had been jumped by DiBiase and Andre.
Yep.
And I'll get back to Jake and Rude in a minute, and that thought I'm trying. But, you know, and they're like, who will Savage's partner be? Who? It's like, really? Like, can you imagine them doing that now?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You'd be watching this, you'd be like, really? Gee, I wonder who he's going to pick. You know, and
yeah,
they really built the drama up for this. Like, and it's like, oh, Hogan's back.
Mm-hmm.
But, with the Jake and Rude thing, it was interesting because, you know, they're relegated to run-ins. I don't know if Rude did a run-in in Jake's match. Jake wins cleanly. Rude, here's another thing, too, doesn't even go over cleanly over JYD. It was a disqualification. Like, I think Jake just ran in mid-match. And for those who weren't around for that program, it was a pretty famous program mm-hmm. for the year. Certainly, you know, one of the top feuds where, you know, they did the Cheryl Roberts love interest, Rick Rude. You know, he started doing the Rude Awakening gimmick after matches where he's making out with women. He wanted to make out with this woman. She refused. It turned out to be Jake Roberts' actual real-life wife, and it was a really good feud, I thought. But they held it off here, and they had them wrestle on Saturday Night's Main Event right after this, if you remember.
Okay.
And all that did, and again, non-finish there.
Yeah.
And what did that do?
Hype it for the house shows.
No.
Yeah.
They did Jake-Andre is what they got. Remember? They used Jake Rude.
Okay.
And they went to a non-finish on Saturday Night's Main Event.
Okay.
Andre was there, and that's where they introduced the Andre Fierce Snakes angle.
Okay.
In October.
All right.
On that Saturday Night's Main Event. They did wrestle in the house shows, Jake and Rude.
That's what I'm guessing.
On my Jake DVD, the Pick Your Poison, which I really like. I thought that was one of the more underrated DVDs.
Okay.
No one talks about that one. I think there was a DDT versus Rude Awakening match. They did it fall, like October of 88 at MSG. A gimmick, by the way, if you have two over finishers, why don't they do something like that anymore where you have to win using your finisher?
They should.
But then again, everyone wins using their finisher now.
Well, yeah.
Most of the time, three times they have to do it. But
from the Department of Redundancy Department, yeah. So you had that one. Again, not much to talk about on the undercard. There is something here where, by the way, too, one last note on the Jake Roberts thing. A very risque program for 88. Cheryl Roberts' face on Rick Rude's trunks.
And remember he ripped the tights off,
yeah,
too?
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
That was,
I would argue that other than the stuff at the top with Savage and DiBiase,
yeah,
which really was just kind of a carryover from WrestleMania 4, wasn't that heated. I mean, they did big money, and we'll talk about that in a minute, on the house shows, had some really good house show matches for the era.
Right.
But that was like the big post-WrestleMania feud, because if you remember, they had that horrible time limit draw at WrestleMania, Jake, but the feud had not started yet, actually.
Oh, it hadn't?
No, it hadn't.
Oh, okay.
When they wrestled, no, there was no, that feud had not. That's why.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's why I think a lot of people are still like, why is this match so not heated and boring? Well, the angle hadn't. It actually.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
okay.
It may have been like the week after. They may have taped it
okay.
already. But it did not air in syndication, the Sheryl Roberts angle, until a week or two after WrestleMania 4, actually.
And if it doesn't air on TV yet, it doesn't count. So no. that's how
especially
it goes.
In this, yeah, I mean, pre-internet era, you get away with it.
A couple notes here from the undercard. I just have to mention this. 21st Century Media Alliance member, the Scout Ken Bex, inexplicably his favorite wrestlers of all time, making their pay-per-view debut with the WWF on this show. The Powers of Pain defeated the Bolsheviks. That was the start of their push in the promotion that year. So, Ken Bex, I've already spent more time talking about the Powers of Pain than they deserve. That one's for you, buddy.
Two things. One is to supplement. We should bring this up, mm-hmm. Ricky. To supplement these podcasts, I will be providing additional commentary on your blog, as you know.
The FDHLounge.blogspot.com, the same place you can find these shows, actually.
Yes,
that's synergy, my friend.
Yes, exactly. And I'll be providing on some of the undercard matches that maybe we don't have the time for.
Okay.
But it's interesting here at the Powers of Pain that they were brought in as faces here, which did not work.
Right.
And remember, they had Baron von Raschke. I mean, who thought that was a good idea?
That was.
It was goofy. It was weird. It's almost weird to watch them as faces.
And it really is, because they weren't very practiced at it, to be sure. The only other thing here, too, I bring this up just largely for my own amusement. Another tag team match on here. I understand that there was no roll of quarters getting involved in this one. The British Bulldogs and the Fabulous Rougeaus right in the middle of their real-life feud.
This was, I think, before.
I think it was probably
because
before.
Because I can't imagine. As a matter of fact, I'm almost positive. That was right before, because if you remember, it was a real red hot button issue before
right.
the Survivor Series
yeah.
to the point that they changed the booking and got the Rougeaus out of the match early.
Yeah.
This was a weird match. We talk about house shows. In many ways, that this match
mm-hmm.
was like the opener of a house show with the tag teams going the full 20 minutes.
Right. That was rare to go 20 minutes on any of these shows, wasn't it?
I mean, on a pay-per-view, sure, yeah.
This was short attention span theater, really.
Yeah, I mean, on the house shows it was common.
Okay.
But you're right, on TV.
Yeah, TV.
No, this was kind of crazy and kind of a weird time period for both teams because it was before the feud,
yep.
the real-life feud. And the Rougeaus had kind of, sort of turned heel, but it was, they hadn't teamed up with Jimmy Hart yet, and it was kind of, I think they may have jumped the Killer Bees on TV at
right.
one point, but regardless, they had not gone full-blown heel. The Bulldogs were clearly being shunted down the card, were gone, you know, within a couple months anyway.
Right.
So, kind of a weird, it was not as good as it could have been.
Right, and by the way, folks, check that out on our YouTube channel, Jacques Rougeau breaking down the real-life match in the back. I believe it was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Or some such, perhaps it was Terre Haute, who knows, against yes. Tom Billington.
And it wasn't Gary.
Yeah. There are much more brutal real-life feuds going on in Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
But on the undercard, yeah, the one thing here, the only real other thing of note on this show, I think you could say, aside from the main event, you had the angle. They'd already run it on TV with Ron Bass and the Spurs. By the way, talk about things that were a little bit graphic for back in the 80s.
It was a weak blade job, though.
Yeah, but it was, you know, when you're implying that a man is running spurs across a man's forehead and you're seeing a gusher, I mean, it might have been 0.4 on the Muda scale, but, you know, it was still not bad, and it was sold pretty strongly by the announcers. So Beefcake out of the match.
He was originally scheduled to challenge the Honky Tonk Man for the Intercontinental title.
Yeah.
And as a continuation from WrestleMania.
Right, right, which one of the many notes of strange continuation between SummerSlam 88 and SummerSlam 90, dude would find himself yanked from the card in 90, but that was art.
Beefcake.
That was life.
Beefcake.
That was life imitating art
yes.
with him going out there. It was, yeah.
Yeah, same. You have a Demolition Heart Foundation tag title match on this show.
Yeah.
Same as 90. Yeah, there's
same
a
as in 90. Yeah, weird continuity. Just on that one real quick, since there's not much worth saying about it, it was Demolition still getting their feet underneath them as tag team champions. Hart Foundation.
This, just turned face.
Yeah. And
again, this was weird time.
And Jimmy Hart wasn't he like advising Mr. Fuji and them as like revenge?
Yeah, and it was the Demolition was, it was, they were kind of still trying to get them over his heels, despite
right.
the fact that everyone wanted to cheer them, which is why they did the double turn with the Powers of Pain at Survivor Series.
Right.
But, you know, every Demolition finish, like those first couple months when they were champions as heels,
right.
was the same. They always used a foreign object to win.
Yeah.
It was like they were in a compromise. They were getting beaten. They used the foreign object, and the ref wasn't looking to win.
Yeah.
They did the exact same finish with the Bulldogs on the house shows for months.
Exactly. And as far as the champions go, again, back to the Honky Tonk Man, the Intercontinental Champion, So you do the whole thing. He's out there in the ring. I'll take on anybody in the back. Ah! And then you hear the music. And a warrior comes out, comes down the aisle there. And it's one of those things. It was really funny because on the Ultimate Warrior burial DVD that they put out, which I saw, which I thought was pretty damn funny. But it's one of those things where in the course of the documentary, I'm not sure in the course of any of the documentaries, you see an entire match that they're referring to. You see the entire match because it's, what, like 29 seconds or whatever.
And say what you will about the Warrior, this was very well done. I think this is the highlight of the show,
this angle.
Because you have to remember, in the pre-internet era, now it would be really easy to guess who they're going to do if they were going to hype. Because they had taken – now it was pretty late in the game when they had taken Beefcake off the card. You know, because if you remember back, it was kind of a curious decision because – Beefcake had been feuding with Honky for months.
Right.
And they just did a thing. They did the angle with Ron Bass to, you know, take the heat off the Beefcake Honky program. And there's this void. And, like, with a couple weeks left, they're like, yeah, well, Honky's still going to defend the Intercontinental title. We just don't know against who. And, you know, in today's, you know, with the internet, in today's environment, everyone would be guessing. And with the Warrior not on the card and as hot as he was getting at the time, people would guess that, and of course they would then frustrate everyone by not doing it and just pissing me off. But this made a lot of sense. It was the right guy at the right time in the right place, MSG.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways it was an appropriate end, I think, for the Honky Tonk Man title run, which we need to say had gone for 15 months at this point. He had won it the June of the previous summer from Ricky Steamboat.
Yeah, 14 months.
And... you know, he obviously it was not their intention for him to have it that long. He was supposed to lose it to Randy Savage in the at the first main event show in February.
Yep.
Before he balked and threatened to walk to the NWA.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, this was a very appropriate ending, and I thought this was the highlight of the show. This whole thing, it was just very well done. And
with the exception of right before the pinfall, do you know what I'm referring to?
No.
Honky Tonk Man blatantly turning himself at like a 90-degree angle to get in position to take the splash.
Well, at that point, Warrior was just going doing his... I mean, they just told him, go out there, run wild. Yeah. And Honky probably had no clue what was going on at that point. He's like, you know, I'm hitting the job squad after this one. You know, who gives a damn?
But probably.
Yeah, I mean, it was... this was very well done, I thought.
It was. It was well executed.
When the music came on, it was kind of funny. Again, you know, we're so conditioned to not think things like this are a big deal now because you're just used to seeing them. But it was really cool when they're like, well, who's it going to be? And then that music starts up, and he just runs out. The crowd goes crazy. I mean, this came across great live.
Right. Let's flash back to what things were like in that era with the TV tapings, and you would tape a bunch of shows before SummerSlam that would air after SummerSlam. What they were doing, I remember reading from the After mags at the time, in order to have the Ultimate Warrior on the shows immediately after SummerSlam coming out with the Intercontinental title belt, what they would do is, at the TV tapings, he would wrestle a dark match against Honky. It would be like a dusty finish where he would appear to win the belt, and then he'd have it for the TV part of it. And then, like, toward the end, it would be like, Jack Tunney has just phoned in a decision from Toronto. The referee's decision is overturned. And they would do that, like, every place they had a
really?
TV taping.
No,
yeah.
No, I didn't know
that. That was how they would
have.
You've
done your homework for this show, I see.
Not so much done my homework as it inexplicably stuck in my head since
1988
when I read it in the aftermath.
Okay, there we go.
But it was that. And then that was the real highlight, I would agree with you. But the main event is what most people remember the show for the most. One of the things I wanted to bring up in talking to you off air, you knew where I was going with this. The original main event of this thing, if you believe Ric Flair's memoirs, it was to have been Ric Flair jumping over from the NWA with the belt against Randy Savage. You brought up a separate thing here about that on the Brother Love show during the show. Supposedly it was going to be the unveiling of the Four Horsemen. That was another alternate scenario.
Yes. I mean, there was a lot of talk. Now, Arn and Tully obviously did come over
very shortly after this
show. There was a big roster turnover. As a matter of fact, if you look at the undercard, there's a lot of guys that are getting shunted on the way out, jobbing to some newer guys, like, you know, your big boss man, your Bad News Browns. But so there's a
Morocco.
there was a big new influx of talent, and the Brainbusters, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, were part of it. But they were also trying to get Flair really hard, and Flair didn't jump. He could have.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do it for another 3 years. And I had forgotten about him saying that. I had never heard that outside of him saying that, the Savage Flair thing. I had read previously, because there's a really hideous waste of time on the show with Brother Love with Jim Duggan. It's so pointless. There's no reason. And I had read that the original plan for the Brother Love show here was to have Flair come out with Arn and Tully. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I read it. So, I mean, but it makes sense. Why would you have a Brother Love segment? I mean, I guess they could have just killed it, you know, when they didn't do it. I mean, they still did. I mean, but it made no sense to do the Jim Duggan thing. So people, the kind of the urban legend is, oh, well, Flair was supposed to debut on this show. And like he said he was going to wrestle. So there was a lot of talk that Flair was going to be on the show.
Here's the funny thing about that before we look at the main event itself here. Four Horsemen 1988, which a lot of people consider to be the best version. It's the one that was inducted into the WWF Hall of Fame this past year.
With Barry Windham as the fourth guy.
If you sign the Four Horsemen in August of 1988, you've signed all of the major title holders of the NWA. The world champion, the world tag team champions, and the U.S. champion, Barry Windham. That would have sucked.
They would have died.
They would have been it. Because they were on the verge of the sale to Crockett. Crockett would have just canceled them like the next week, not even bought them. That would have been
it. You mean Turner?
Turner buying from Crockett. Turner would have canceled Crockett.
Yeah, he wouldn't have. You're right. You know what's really funny is who knows what would have happened to Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
Because Flair stayed. And he didn't want Dusty booking anymore.
Right.
And they ran him out of town, and he wound up coming to WWF, which if, you know, Flair would have come, you know, they may still have signed Dusty and put him in the polka dots, but who knows?
Very, very, very strange turn of events, but it ended up being, as you said, the very, very predictable turn of events. Ooh, who's going to team with Randy Savage? And it ends up being Hulk Hogan. And then they, to put a little bit of extra intrigue in it, they did the whole angle with Elizabeth. What's she going to do as a distraction? Jesse Ventura.
As the
special referee trying to load the deck in favor of the bad guys and everything. And it, again, like, and I know you disagree with me on the extent to which, but again, WrestleMania 3, Hogan, Andre, whatever, there was an aura still about Andre at that time such that that match, again, was it a great match in the main event of that thing there? No, notwithstanding the fact that Savage and DiBiase were two of the greatest wrestlers of all time, but two great wrestlers with those guys, two great aura guys in Hogan and Andre. It did have that special moment in time that they thought that they really wanted to have kind of cement and sum up SummerSlam 88. I think they succeeded in that way for a very memorable thing that, you know, in some ways, you know, people are still going to be talking about decades from now. What was the build up to the first SummerSlam?
I would say, well, I thought in many ways the bloom was kind of off the Andre Rose, but I mean, because you talk about his aura. Once he loses at WrestleMania 3, that aura sort of takes a major hit, which is fine because you had to give it to Hogan.
Never as strong, but he still had enough left to make it a special moment.
But, you know, kind of after this, it was sort of downhill because, you know, again, he goes that awful feud with Jake Roberts that I hate so much. And, you know, even DiBiase, this was kind of his last hurrah at the top of the card, too. You know, he kind of got shunted down, did some stuff with Hercules after this, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting, though, where they do something and actually get something with the show moving forward is they began to plant the seeds of the mega powers exploding.
Right.
Which was as well done a program as this company's ever done.
Right.
Long term. You know, Hogan came back. And by the way, Savage and DiBiase drew some good houses over the summer with some good Hoganless houses. You know, people were very scared when Hogan went to film No Holds Barred that, oh, God, the house shows are going to collapse without him.
Mm-hmm.
Savage and DiBiase did a very good job on top all summer. They had that great cage match, you know, that I believe is on the Randy Savage DVD, one of the better house show matches of the 80s. But
it got stale by late summer. They just milked it too much on the house shows. I believe there were diminishing returns in terms of crowds.
Well, sure, of course. There always will be when you do that. Because, I mean, WrestleMania to summer, that's 4 months.
Yeah,
I mean,
they beat the crap out of it on the whole thing around the horn a few times.
Yeah. And they did a lot of DQ finishes building up to the cage match and stuff. But, you know, I mean, it was still four superstars. Keep in mind, I mean, what you had back then, syndication, you didn't have cards like this. So this card was still a big deal then. Now it wouldn't be so much, but the key I thought is I didn't like Hogan put Elizabeth up on his shoulder and they showed Savage kind of like giving him like a dirty look. It was very subtle, but it would always get replayed, you know, throughout history. or when they built, when they finally did do the Savage heel turn and they built to the match at WrestleMania. It did start here, and I thought it was very well done as they went through Survivor Series and then the Royal Rumble and then obviously the actual heel turn on NBC in February of 89. I think this is one of the worst summer. I think this might be the worst SummerSlam ever, though.
Yeah, it very well might be because, again, the undercard just sucked such a big one.
Just because what you've come to expect from a pay-per-view now,
right?
That there's not a lot to sink your teeth into in this puppy. Not as far as match quality goes, not a lot. The most memorable angle is like a 30-second thing. So I would rate this as one of the two or three worst easily, if not the worst. This might actually be the worst SummerSlam.
I'd be hard-pressed to argue with that. What it didn't even have the benefit of, and we'll be talking about this as we go through the subsequent ones, those swank little six-man tags that they would do from time to time where they would temporarily break down the Berlin Wall. It was almost like it was a separate promotion with the tag team wrestlers and with the singles wrestlers.
A separate division.
It was. But, I mean, again, I was always an NWA guy. I like to see things where, my guy Ronnie Garvin might have a program with three guys going at the same time. Maybe two of them would be singles programs, one of them would be tag programs, whatever. I liked the intermingling, the commingling between there. You didn't have that except for whenever you would have these six-man tags and you would let the issues kind of like bleed over and everything like that. The other thing, too, being an NWA guy, and this is maybe a separate matter, but what I didn't like, it took for there to be like a six-man tag match. You hardly ever had like association even within a stable. As somebody who grew up with the Four Horsemen and they were all like, when did Jimmy Hart's first family ever, or not, I guess they weren't the first family when they were there because you had the Heenan family, but Jimmy Hart's group. You didn't hardly ever have them doing much amongst themselves. The Heenan family, there was like five separate guys who might as well be dressing in five separate dressing rooms that Bobby Heenan is managing.
I remember there were some six and eight man tags on Wrestling Challenge.
Just wasn't much continuity between the groups.
Hulk and Hart Foundation had a, they teamed up for a little bit. The big Mega Powers angle. There was
just wasn't as much as you would like. I'm using that to say that.
Well, it's nothing like today where you constantly have guys out there and stuff. I mean,
well, today the associations mean nothing. Between brands, but I'm just saying 88 sucked because you didn't even have that like you would have at some of the subsequent ones here.
I just think it's when you look at it, no good matches. There was no programs that were really blown off here. I think that when you look at 88, outside of the return of Hogan, which obviously was sufficient enough to do a pay-per-view, you're just having Hulk Hogan come back for the first time in a couple months to wrestle on television. They thought was enough here, and it obviously was enough to justify an entire pay-per-view franchise. But other than that, there's not, in the Ultimate Warrior's memorable Intercontinental title win, there's just not a lot here. Like I think if you're a newer fan that didn't watch during this time period, you would get very bored with the show.
Can we say also that, again, they approached the first SummerSlam like they did the first WrestleMania, where They just really coasted on the main event. The first WrestleMania,
a glorified house show. A couple programs. Yeah. There was a couple programs touched on, but you're right. That was basically a one-match show, and this was two. And the one match, while it had four big names, and it's not great. I've never heard anyone say, I really want to have a hankering to watch right now is the Mega Powers versus the Mega Bucks.
No.
No one says that.
No, nobody has that kind of nostalgia for it. But when we get to the next ones here, again, you would find a lot of the same stuff, but I know in 89 when we get to that, there are glimmers of
that's a good show, I think. Particularly the first half's a very good show.
There are. And in our next mini episode here, I think we're going to be talking 89 and 90. So we'll be doing that. But meantime, you've been listening to part 1A of the SummerSlam History Series here with Kyle Ross.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio,
Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Paper Mate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.